ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, the aristocrat formerly known as Prince Andrew. The king strips his younger brother of his royal title over his links to pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Also, Victoria passes a landmark treaty with Indigenous Australians, should other states follow suit, and a precious resource, the community fight against the shutdown of public swimming pools.
Honestly, I feel sad, I feel heartbroken, because I've been coming to that swimming pool for over 20 years.
What am I going to do? You know, that's our health and well-being. Get together, see all the friends, see all the community.
Prince Andrew has been stripped of his titles and his home, his humiliation complete after years of controversy over his ties to the convicted sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. The family of Epstein accuser Virginia Giuffre have welcomed the news that Prince Andrew will be stripped of his royal title, saying it's a victory for her and other survivors. King Charles has also ordered the former prince, now known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, to vacate his lease of the Royal Lodge. Alison Shaw reports.
How long have you known about Andrew and Epstein?
Three days ago, King Charles was smiling and waving to royal fans outside Lichfield Cathedral near Birmingham when he was peppered with questions like, have you ever asked police to cover up for Andrew?
Have you asked the police to cover up for Andrew?
Now the king has stripped his brother of his royal titles, announcing the decision in a statement from Buckingham Palace. The move's been welcomed by many Londoners.
I think we all saw it coming, to be honest. As soon as the first thing came out, we all know immediately Sam was wrong.
I think it's fair. I also think that they should release the list. I also think that anyone who does quote-unquote unbecoming things deserves that kind of treatment, yeah.
I'm happy he's got stripped of his titles, his royal titles as well. He should be kicked out of the country because, you know, these guys live off us. You know, we're the working class, we're the people in charge.
Andrew will now be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and not as a prince or duke. He's also been told to vacate his 30-room mansion on the grounds of Windsor Palace. He'll remain eighth in line to the throne after Prince William and Prince Harry and their children. Historian Anthony Seldon describes it as a radical move.
In some ways, you go back to the abdication, or indeed back to 1917, the last time that princes had their titles stripped from them. For misbehaviour in that case, it was fighting on the German side in the First World War. So we haven't seen something like this for 100 years. It is a huge moment in the royal family, but I think it will be a turning point.
For over a decade, controversy has dogged Andrew and the royal family as a result of his connection to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Earlier this month, Virginia Roberts Giuffre's posthumous memoir, Nobody's Girl, was released, containing allegations she was forced to have sex with Andrew on three separate occasions, the first time when she was 17 years old and he was 41. Andrew has strenuously denied the claims and says he never met Ms. Roberts Giuffre, but settled a civil lawsuit for an undisclosed sum in 2022. Today, her brother, Sky Roberts, spoke to the BBC.
I would say she'd be so proud. He's just Andrew. He's no longer a prince. And she is celebrating from the heavens right now, saying, I did it. This normal girl from a normal family has taken down a prince. We are so proud of her. Her survivors are proud of her. Her sisters. This is a moment that is unprecedented in history.
But Virginia Roberts Giuffre's family don't want it to stop there. Her brother calling for more action to be taken.
It's not enough. We have to have some sort of investigation that goes further into this. I mean, he's still walking around a free man. I commend the king. I think he's doing an amazing job as a world leader, setting a precedent. But we need to take it one more step further. He needs to be behind bars, period.
Royal commentators believe the King's decision wouldn't have been made lightly. Sarah Hewson is a royal correspondent based in the UK.
Let's not forget, Queen Camilla is a huge campaigner against domestic violence and supporter of victims of abuse, as is the Duchess of Edinburgh, Sophie. This has been extremely difficult for them to have a member of their own family accused, albeit denying those allegations, but to be accused of sexually abusing a 17-year-old girl, Virginia Giuffre. This has been hugely damaging. They have been stained by their association and their closeness to Andrew.
Andrew is now expected to move to a property on the King's Sandringham estate.
Now, that's significant because Sandringham is a private residence owned by the monarch. It means there's no crown estate, there's no taxpayer element in this.
Many Republicans in Australia believe this moment could be a turning point. Peter Fitzsimons is the former chairman of the Australian Republic Movement.
It is seismic, and I'm reminded of that famous quote by Vladimir Lenin 100 years ago. He said, sometimes there are decades when nothing happens and then weeks when decades happen. And this feels like this has been a long coming and this is the week when it's happening. But the record speaks for itself that the royal family has protected this bloke for decades. And, you know, they are now reaping what they sowed.
The Australian Monarchist League said in a statement, the crown itself is untarnished and will continue on protecting the constitutional rights of the Australian people. It said Andrew had been extremely foolish, but noted he'd never been criminally charged for any offence in the UK or in the US. Andrew's daughters, Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie, will retain their princess titles, but it's widely expected Andrew and his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, will now remain away from the public eye altogether.
Alison Shaw reporting to South Korea, where the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he's working to boost economic ties and open up trade at the APEC summit. Mr. Albanese is attending the conference a day after the United States and China struck a new deal aimed at de-escalating trade tensions. The ABC's North Asia correspondent, James Oten, is at the summit and he joined me a short time ago. James, what's top of the agenda for the APEC summit?
Well, first of all, the South Korean president painted a pretty bleak picture. He had some words of worry when the APEC summit began, telling the leaders that are present here that the world is at a critical inflection point. He was talking about that economic uncertainty is deepening and that the momentum for trade and investment is weakening. This obviously goes against what the APEC summit is about. APEC brings together 21 economies from across the Pacific, from Japan down to Australia, then across to Chile and up to the United States and Canada, representing more than half of world trade. And it's always been about ensuring freer and fairer trade. But of course, the South Korean president, without explicitly mentioning this, we've just seen this trade war between the United States and China, and we've seen the United States impose tariffs across all these major trading partners. Now, though there was some resolution yesterday, it's still very much at the front of mind for all the leaders here. So that's the challenge that the South Korean leader has put forward, that he wants these APEC leaders to reach unity. He acknowledged that when we're dealing with such a diverse range of economies, like I mentioned, we've got places like Russia and China here, and Japan and the United States, when you've got such diversity, it's not always possible to agree. But the main focus for South Korea here will be to try and get these world leaders to reach commonality and make a final statement. APEC summits are non-binding, but there have been summits in the past where they've been unable to reach agreement. So if they can reach an agreement, come up with a common statement for some new rules and ways that they're going to promote trade, well, that will be chalked up as a significant win. Now, the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is here at APEC, and we asked him what his thoughts were about the South Korean president's remarks. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Well, that is an observation based upon, I think, the assessment that Australia shares a concern about any winding back of free and fair trade. We think that the world benefits from free and fair trade. I'm someone who has advocated that very strongly. Sovereign states, of course, are up to them to make their own decisions. But Australia's very consistent about our view. That is one of the reasons why we were responsible for the first ever APEC meeting.
And James, while the US President Donald Trump has left APEC, China's President Xi Jinping is still there. What's he had to say?
Yeah, well, I guess this actually has a lot of symbolism here because you've got Donald Trump that has retreated back to the United States, and his announcement earlier this year that he would be imposing these aggressive tariffs against all these major economies really has gone backwards in terms of this free and fair trade notion that APEC is all about. And even though he struck a deal yesterday that will see some tariffs reduced against China, meanwhile, China will pause its restrictions of the rare earths trade, you can see that the matter is not fully resolved. There are still plenty of tariffs, quite high tariffs. It's more expensive to trade with the United States today than it was a year ago. And as I mentioned, China's agreed to pause its restrictions on rare earths. So it could come into play again. But importantly, when President Xi Jinping is still here at APEC, he's been talking about his effort to try and promote freer and fairer trade while Donald Trump has left. And I think you will see some analysis pieces making that point that the United States has left and Xi Jinping is here. And that is symbolic that China can say we believe in multilateralism. So he did say to the leaders here that we must adhere to the principle of joining hands rather than letting go and extending chains rather than breaking chains and actively seeking more points of convergence. So that's what China's President Xi Jinping had to say as he promotes his presence here at the APEC summit. We do know that Anthony Albanese met with Xi Jinping this morning, but the media asked him about what was discussed. But unfortunately, he said it was a private conversation, so we won't go into further details about that. But as I mentioned, Xi Jinping is here for the APEC summit, while the US President Donald Trump is now back in the US.
James Oaten there. This is PM. I'm Stephanie Smale. Cricketers across the world have paid tribute to 17-year-old Ben Austin, who died after being hit in the neck by a ball during training. It came from a ball-throwing device known as a wanger, similar to those used by dog owners to launch tennis balls. One South Australian club has already banned junior players from using those devices due to safety concerns. Angus Randall reports.
At Junction Oval in Melbourne, cricket fans watched the final day of a Shield match between Victoria and Tasmania, overshadowed by the death of a young cricketer only a few kilometres away.
You kind of think of cricket naturally as a pretty safe and easygoing sport, so I won't lie, I was straight on the Greg Chappell Cricket Centre this morning looking up stem guard protectors for the helmet.
So sad for them. My children have played cricket all their lives and sometimes it's easy to forget it is a dangerous sport.
It's just a horrible thing to happen and we don't want to see it happen again.
Players are wearing black armbands in tribute to 17-year-old Ben Austin, who died after being struck in the neck with a cricket ball during a training session on Tuesday. Ferntree Gully Cricket Club coach Josh Henry says he leaves a lasting legacy despite his life being cut so short.
He was just a really loving, caring, beautiful boy. He loved his cricket, he loved his mates, he loved the club. He was a leader.
It's drawn comparisons to the death of Test cricketer Philip Hughes, who was hit in the neck at the SCG 11 years ago. That led to neck guards, also known as stem guards, to be made mandatory in professional cricket when facing a fast bowler. However, that's not the case for junior players. In this case, Ben Austin was wearing a helmet, but not a stem guard. Nick Cummins is the CEO of Cricket Victoria. He says the focus right now is on supporting the club and the families of both Ben and the player who threw the ball.
We've done everything we can for Ben, but there is another family that needs our support as well. So that's our priority. At the right time, we will have a look at all of our safety procedures.
An independent investigation into the Philip Hughes incident found it unlikely that a stem guard would have prevented his death. However, manufacturers say the technology has improved since then. But in the wake of this latest incident, there are also safety concerns about the use of a handheld ball thrower called a wanger. It's similar to the device used by dog owners to throw a tennis ball. Former Australia coach Darren Lehman says the wanger may look simple, but it's deceptively dangerous.
That's one of the things, skills you probably need to have as a coach. And if you're helping out through juniors, you need to be able to use it properly because it can actually come down quite fast. So it's one of those ones that they've got to look at as well.
One Adelaide Cricket Club has already banned anyone under the age of 18 from using or facing a ball from a wanger in the wake of this tragedy. Goodwood Cricket Club's junior coordinator is Andy Shea.
You know, a lot of our boys, a lot of the parents, even who are just volunteer coaches, don't know how to use them properly. For us, the conversation is now is that, you know, we can prevent and stop the use of them for the moment. But obviously, at some point, we're going to need to train people how to use them.
Peter Bruckner is a professor of sports medicine at La Trobe University and was Cricket Australia's chief doctor when Philip Hughes died. He wants to keep the focus on mandatory head and neck protection rather than getting rid of the wanger.
It replicates what happens in a cricket match, so it's not any different. I think the issue is you know, we've just got to make sure the head and neck protection is present all the time.
Cricket Australia chair Mike Baird says there are things to learn from the incident, but supporting Ben Austin's family is the current focus.
Angus Randall reporting. Victoria's move to become the first Australian state to establish a treaty with its First Nations people has been described as a turning point for Indigenous relations. One of the first tasks will be to discuss how treaty can improve health, education and housing outcomes for Indigenous people. But what does this shift in relations mean for Australia as a whole? Deanna Damjanovic reports.
Cheers filled the parliament and Indigenous flags were unfurled as a bill to establish a treaty between the state of Victoria and its First Nations people passed without amendment. Travis Lovett is a former commissioner of the Yurok Justice Commission.
As we know, and as we've said for a couple of centuries now, we want to make the decisions that affect our lives. And when we are involved in the decisions that affect our lives, we know that there's better outcomes because they're led by us and developed by us as well.
The Victorian Treaty and the authority it creates, Kaalung Wal, has the potential to become a powerful voice for Indigenous Australians. It allows for the Victorian First Peoples Assembly to address Parliament once a year, provides for guaranteed meetings with ministers and departmental staff, including the Victorian Commissioner of Police, and it promises to put Victorian First Nations concerns and aspirations on the public record.
It's a key part of this is also about healing for our people, but not just our people, for all of society to come together and heal. We want to move past the injustices. This treaty gives us in Victoria the chance, but also gives confidence in the rest of the nation that truth and treaty are not divisive and that they should be invested in.
It seems fundamentally unreasonable for governments to make policy without consideration for the effect of those policies. So it's a basic democratic right at one level, but it also recognises that the state of Victoria was established without First Nations people's consent or involvement.
That's Dominic O'Sullivan, professor in political science at Charles Sturt University. Victoria now becomes the first and only state in Australia to have an Indigenous treaty. The process led by the findings from the Yurok Justice Commission, a truth-telling process which received more than 1,000 submissions and conducted more than 2 months of public hearings.
The state of Victoria has done an awful lot of harm to First Nations people over the years through alienation of land, sometimes racial profiling of people by the police force, and those sorts of things are all things that people can only challenge if they've got an assured voice and a structured voice. And I think that's what the treaty offers.
At the national level, Australia remains the only Commonwealth country without a federal treaty with its Indigenous people. New Zealand established the Treaty of Waitangi or Te Tiriti in 1840. And while there are criticisms of it, it remains central to New Zealand and its constitution. Dominic O'Sullivan says there continues to be disputes about the role the Treaty of Waitangi has in modern-day New Zealand.
So in today's politics, debates really centre around just how much influence Te Tiriti should have. To what extent is the state a colonial power, or to what extent is it an authority that belongs to everyone and should serve everyone equally well? Not everybody agrees that the state should serve Māori people as well as it serves others.
But he argues the treaty-making process needs to be underpinned by a shared aspiration of equality for all.
The ideal is that it's no longer a case of government being an entity that does things to people, but government being an entity that belongs to everyone and is responsive to everyone.
Dominic O'Sullivan, Professor in Political Science at Charles Sturt University, ending that report by Diana Damjanovic. Public swimming pools are crucial in the fight to keep drowning rates down, particularly among migrant communities. But hundreds of community pools are at risk of closing in Australia if they can't find the funding support to keep them afloat. Researchers are warning it's a dangerous trend, and if people don't have a place to learn to swim, the consequences could be deadly. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
For 70 years, the Heidelberg West public swimming pool has served the needs of the local community. But now, the council says it can't afford to keep it. Its entry gates closing for the last time today, to the regret of locals like Najma Mercer.
Honestly, I feel sad, I feel heartbroken, because I've been coming to that swimming pool for over 20 years.
The pool in Melbourne's northeast was built in 1956 for athletes competing in the Melbourne Games.
The Australians have dominated the swimming so far.
Nowadays, Heidelberg West is a low socio-economic area with a huge migrant population. Prominent women's group, the Muslim Sisters of Banyul, have been using the pool every Friday for 25 years.
Back home, we never had opportunity kind of swimming, doing all this kind of activity. I was born in a war-torn country.
Amina Hassan first moved to Australia from Kenya in 2008. She came to the leisure centre to socialise with other women and children in her community.
You know, what am I going to do? That Friday night was a very special night for all the Muslim women lives around the area. That's our health and well-being. Get together, see all the friends, see all the community.
This week, the community made one last effort to keep the pool open, protesting outside the Banyul Council offices.
Save our pool! Save our pool!
In a Freedom of Information document, the council blames its demise on a lack of funding, promising to find an alternative solution for the women. Bethany Moore is a lawyer representing the group to make sure the council follows through.
For them, using the Olympic Leisure Centre is a really big part of their practice in terms of engaging together, but also engaging in exercise and other activities that are really supportive for their well-being.
Drowning rates in migrant communities are rising. The latest national report estimates one in three people who drown are born overseas. And despite a push for more water safety programs to reverse that trend, community pools around the country are continuing to close, mostly due to funding challenges. Royal Life Saving Australia estimates at least 500 public pools will close within the next 10 years without proper investment. Elizabeth Taylor from Monash University is doing a research project into the closures.
First of all, there's no guaranteed funding or security for any public pool. Councils just have to try to figure out how to keep them going, and there's no certainty at all. Most of our public swimming pools are over 50 years old.
Australia is not alone. In the UK, England has lost almost 400 swimming pools in the last 10 years due to funding issues. It's a similar story in South Africa, where 10% of public pools in the city of Johannesburg have closed in the last 5 years due to irreparable damage. Here, Elizabeth Taylor believes the closure of facilities like West Heidelberg's will have far-reaching consequences.
Those benchmarks for ability to swim are consistently getting worse, and we're also seeing the drowning rate go up and up each year. That must be a combination of declining swimming skills and also just fewer places where you can safely learn to swim.
In a statement, the Banyul Council says the pool in West Heidelberg is beyond repair and it plans to build a library instead. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the Federal Minister for Infrastructure and Local Government, Catherine King, has told the ABC that it's providing funding for eligible pool projects through its Growing Regions and Thriving Suburbs programs. That may well be too late for West Heidelberg, however, with both programs no longer longer open for new applications.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting, and that's PM for this week. PM's producer is Nick Grimm. Technical production by Joram Toth and Nick Draculis. I'm Stephanie Smale. We'll be back on Monday evening. Have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Home invasions, stabbings, carjackings. In Victoria, there's been a wave of serious and violent crimes. But is it right to label Melbourne the crime capital of Australia? Today, ABC Melbourne Mornings presenter Raphael Epstein. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.